This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Down to Business. My name is Jeff, and I'm recording this episode from the Mind's Eye studio just outside St. Louis in Belleville, Illinois. In today's episode, we'll explore a variety of stories from some of my favorite business publications, including Fast Company, Fortune, and Forbes. So settle in. It's time to get down to business. Our first article for this episode comes from Forbes, and the title is Put Together a Professional Team for Your Small Business. When my husband and I opened our law firm, we were confident. We had a name, a business plan, office space, and a website. We had thought of everything except paperwork and more paperwork. We had not considered just how much time we would spend sorting through canceled checks, bank statements, payroll stubs, and letters from various tax authorities regarding regulations. While as a tax lawyer, I well understood that taxes needed to be filed quarterly, I hadn't done the math. Quarterly filings for federal, state, and local taxes meant 12 separate submissions a year just for income taxes. We also had to file federal, state, and local payroll taxes, unemployment taxes, and business development taxes. We were required to register with the state and submit annual reports. When we changed the sign out front, we had to obtain approval from our local authorities and pay a fee. There was even a separate annual fee for having a private alarm company. We needed to maintain business liability insurance, professional insurance, workers' comp, and health insurance as well. Did I mention there were only two of us at this time? Running a business involves more than just flipping the lights on, especially if you want to do things the right way, and trust me, you do. This reality often conflicts with the amount of time you have to spend actually managing your business. What's the solution? Surround yourself with good people, not just capable employees, but a professional team dedicated to handling all the compliance issues so that you can focus on what you wanted to do in the first place, and that's run your business. It's true that a professional team costs money, something that startups and small businesses are often short on, but consider this. First, many matters, including bookkeeping and tax preparation, don't have to be surprises. You can budget these costs in advance. And second, time is money. Every hour that you spend sorting through your own banking statements or trying to figure out the nuances on Form 941 is taking away from the business of making money. Who should be on your small business team? First, a good tax preparer. The IRS reports that business taxpayers spend an average of 24 hours completing their federal income tax return. This includes 11 hours devoted to record keeping, 5 hours for tax planning, and 8 hours for completing and submitting forms. That's more than half of one work week on one form. Taxpayers who sell or perform services across state or local lines face even more complexity, including computing and remitting sales tax. U.S. sales tax rates not only vary by state, but also by city and county, according to the tax compliance software company Avalara. There are more than 13,000 sales tax jurisdictions in the U.S., and those rates, they're constantly changing. There's also a learning curve. The recent House-passed tax bill, now officially named the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, weighed in at over 1,000 pages, and it's still being worked on. 4 years ago, the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021 made changes to Form 1099-K, reporting requirements for third-party payment networks like PayPal and Venmo, and online marketplaces that impacted small businesses. Since then, the IRS has walked back implementation, leaving some taxpayers confused. Processing all those changes and the changes to the changes can be time-consuming and frustrating. So you could do this all on your own, but chances are you'd be too busy with other things. A tax preparer does not need a specific credential to be competent. However, by law, anyone paid to prepare or assist in preparing federal tax returns must have a valid preparer tax identification number, or PTIN. Paid tax preparers are required to sign and include their PTIN on the taxpayer's return. Fortunately for business taxpayers, it's all tax deductible. Additionally, a good tax preparer can also flag potential audit issues and point out areas where you might be wasting deductions or credits. Next, a good bookkeeper. Bookkeeping is, at its most basic, the recording of financial transactions. However, Nicole Davis, the founder and CEO of Georgia-based Butler Davis Tax and Accounting, warns that it is more than simply balancing a checkbook, especially for small businesses. It includes recording receipts and expenditures, tracking accounts receivable and accounts payable, as well as potentially managing inventory and loans. That's why every business needs a competent person to manage the books. This might be the same person as your tax preparer, or it could be somebody different. Today, there are in-house fractional and virtual bookkeeping options, making it easy to find someone to fit your model, time frame, and budget. No matter how you arrange it, solid record keeping is important. The most obvious reason to have routine bookkeeping is that it helps you at tax time. If you're organized all year, there's no last-minute scramble, plus regularly reviewing the books means you're less likely to miss something. Good bookkeeping also helps you understand the financial health of your business. Just because you're paying your bills doesn't mean your business is on track for success. When we first started our business, our local banker would chirp, "Cash flow." We knew it was important, but we didn't realize how crucial it was until a major client who had incurred a very large bill was unable to pay due to unfortunate circumstances, a nice way of saying that he had been sent to prison. Suddenly, those account receivables weren't as meaningful because they didn't translate into cash flow. Bookkeepers can generate a lot of reports. Jenny Groberg, CEO of BookSmarts Accounting and Bookkeeping in Utah, recommends that businesses focus on one type of statement, a profit and loss statement or P&L statement. This is a financial report that summarizes your income and losses during a specific period, like a quarter or a fiscal year. In short, it shows how much money you're making or losing. As a business owner, I don't want to have to beg clients for money. I'm terrible at it, and I find it awkward to ask for money in one breath and offer legal advice in the next. Bookkeepers can prepare and send invoices and issue dunning letters when the clients haven't paid. I know who has paid and who hasn't. I intervene when necessary, but having a bookkeeper make those requests allows me to maintain a professional relationship with the clients. I don't want to spend all my time in the financial weeds when I need to be building and growing my business, and neither do you. Having someone help keep the books organized is well worth the cost. Next, lawyers. I know people hate lawyers, but you need them, trust me. And you need lawyers, plural, as part of your team. Think of lawyers as you do doctors. If you're healthy, you don't need to see your doctor every month, but you will require an occasional checkup. Checking in at least once a year with a knowledgeable business lawyer to ensure that you're complying with corporate formalities will help keep your business healthy. Of course, when you get sick, you see a doctor. The same analysis applies to a lawyer. When you have a problem, pick up the phone. Don't wait for it to fester. Chances are, like an infection, a legal issue will only get worse without attention. And what about when you do have a specific ache, like a pain in your chest? You see a cardiologist. You don't go to the dermatologist. Ditto for legal services. Your divorce attorney typically shouldn't be handling your trademark issues. Your tax attorney shouldn't be handling your criminal law matter. While it's true that some areas of the law overlap, like tax and business, most lawyers are not one size fits all. The law is vast and complicated. No one knows everything. Lawyers can do more than help you fix what goes wrong. They can help you stay compliant with changing rules and regulation so that things don't go wrong. For example, during much of 2024, the Treasury Department touted registration under the Corporate Transparency Act, or CTA. This year, under the new Trump administration, Treasury walked back most of the CTA, limiting its scope to foreign companies. Before the revision, however, an estimated 32.6 million companies were potentially subject to reporting requirements, with significant penalties for non-compliance. Having a lawyer stay on top of these kinds of matters as they relate to your business can help you avoid problems down the road. When you're just getting started, it's wise to know a good corporate lawyer, a good tax lawyer, and a good intellectual property lawyer. They might be at the same firm or they may not be. The size of the firm doesn't always correlate to the quality of the work. You don't have to pay lawyers to have them in your speed dial, but you do want to be able to call them when you need help. Next, insurance brokers. I had no idea how much insurance I needed until I started my own business. There was general liability insurance, business premises insurance, professional malpractice insurance, health insurance, life insurance, and disability insurance. I began, like many businesses, by making a few phone calls and obtaining coverage in small pieces on my own. But then things changed. We hired more people, bought a building and moved. I couldn't figure out whether I was overinsured, underinsured, or just so. So I went to the experts. It's the job of the insurance broker to explain and coordinate different kinds of coverages. They'll work with you to figure out exactly what you need and offer different solutions based on industry, geography, and cost. What about that cost? Ed McConnell, president of Total Benefits Solution in Pennsylvania, says that brokers are paid differently depending on the client. When it comes to health insurance, brokers are typically paid a commission by the insurer, which means that it costs you as the business owner nothing out of pocket, since the cost was already included in the premium expense. Brokers may also be paid on a fee basis depending on the services. Insurance brokers just don't collect a check for premiums. They can assist with compliance issues, advise on best practices, and help with healthcare reimbursements and settling benefit issues. Retirement plan administrators. One of the most challenging aspects of running your own business can be giving up the benefits you once enjoyed. One often overlooked benefit of a small business is a retirement plan. It can feel like a luxury. One of my fellow small business owners once burst into laughter when I mentioned setting up a 401k. And it can be complicated by a host of rules and regulations. While small businesses used to be limited to one or two options, there are now many different kinds of retirement plans for small businesses to choose from. A retirement plan administrator can explain your options, as well as what you're not allowed to do, walk you through the process, and keep you on top of what you need for your compliance purposes. That might include flagging due dates for returns, figuring limits and caps for plans, and assisting with the filing of annual reports. Retirement plan administrators can also advise on whether plans are subject to the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, or ERISA, a federal law that governs retirement and health plans, including whether you need to provide certain kinds of notices to your employees. Like insurance brokers, many retirement plan administrators operate on a commission or fee-for-service basis. Be sure to ask up front. Next, payroll services. Throughout my years of practice, one mistake made by a small business stands out as the most, failing to manage payroll effectively. For wage earners, Social Security and Medicare taxes are called FICA and are taken out of your paycheck. Taxes on self-employment income are sometimes called SECA, or Self-Employment Contributions Act, since self-employment persons pay both the employee and the employer contributions. If you're a wage earner, your employer collects your Social Security and Medicare payments and remits both their portion and your share to the government. Employers, including small business owners, have a legal obligation to make the remittance. If that doesn't happen on time, there can be serious consequences. For example, a trust fund recovery penalty may apply. The penalty is 100% of the unpaid trust fund tax and may be imposed on those the IRS deems responsible for collecting or paying the tax. That means that the liability becomes personal as opposed to a business liability and isn't easily discharged. Even more serious, those employers or responsible persons who fail to pay over trust fund taxes may be subject to criminal charges. Sentences can result in restitution and, in some cases, jail time. Payroll taxes, including withholding, should be immediately set aside to be paid over the next tax authorities. I always recommend maintaining a separate account for this purpose. However, it can be tempting for some business owners to dip into those funds when cash is low. They often figure that they'll just borrow the money now and put it back later, but for many business owners, later never comes. Instead, tax liabilities multiply. The solution for most businesses? Hire a payroll company. Outsourcing payroll to a payroll company can be a significant time saver for small businesses. Payroll companies will figure out how much is owed for federal, state, and local purposes and can remit payments straight from your checking account. They can also create reports and coordinate with your bookkeeper and tax preparer to help ensure that you, your employees, and the tax authorities get paid on time. So what's next? Now that you know whom you need, how do you go about assembling your team? Here are some tips. First, ask your friends and colleagues who they use. As in any service business, referrals are the best way to find a good fit. Next, do your homework. Check credentials online and explore networking sites like LinkedIn for potential leads. Third, ask other professionals for recommendations, since most are happy to pass along a few names. And finally, check out lists like the Forbes Best In-State CPAs, where you should take some accolades with a grain of salt. People may pay to be mentioned on some of those lists. Peer-recommended or vetted lists are a good place to start. When you identify someone who might be a good fit, set up a time to ask questions about their background, their work processes, timelines, and their style. And as you add members, remember that you're building a team, not a group of strangers. While your team doesn't have to be best friends, you should make sure that the folks you choose feel comfortable communicating with each other. If your bookkeeper won't schedule time to talk to your tax preparer, it creates more work for everyone. And if your tax attorney crafts a great benefit plan for your business but fails to communicate the specifics to your retirement broker, the plan is meaningless. Don't be afraid to explain that you're not happy or let someone go if they're not working out. If they're not willing to be part of your team, they aren't useful to you. Our next article continues with Forbes magazine, and it's called Why Small Business Owners Should Hire a Consultant. Running a small business is a bold and courageous endeavor. It demands grit, creativity, and an extraordinary ability to wear multiple hats all at once. You juggle sales, marketing, operations, customer service, and finance, sometimes with no formal training in any of them. In this high-stakes balancing act, the right support can make all the difference in the world. This is where consultants come in, not as temporary fixers, but as strategic allies who help small business owners build more resilient, scalable, and successful enterprises. But here's the challenge. Not all consultants are created equal, and not every expert adds value. In today's entrepreneurial landscape, where uncertainty is constant and speed is critical, small business owners need to choose consultants carefully. In this article, we'll explore why having an entrepreneurial consultant isn't a luxury, but a smart investment, and what to look for when choosing one. Why consultants matter more than ever for small business owners. Contrary to popular belief, business consultants aren't just for large corporations with deep pockets. In fact, small businesses may stand to benefit even more from external expertise, especially when resources, time, and experiences are limited. Think of consultants as accelerators. They help business owners clarify direction, identify blind spots, avoid costly mistakes, and move faster toward their goals. Small businesses create two-thirds of net new jobs in the U.S. economy, but face disproportionate barriers to accessing strategic advice, especially in finance, technology, and operation. Consultants bridge those gaps. Consultants can also prevent burnout. Too many founders work in the business rather than on the business. A good consultant steps in with systems, strategies, and accountability so the founder can reclaim their energy and focus on what matters most. Why the right kind of entrepreneurial consultant matters. While there's no shortage of professionals offering advice, not everyone who calls themselves a consultant is equipped to support small businesses. Beyond knowledge, the right consultant brings alignment, empathy, and real-world practicality. Let's break down what truly sets great business consultants apart. First, they think like entrepreneurs, not just advisors. You want a consultant who understands what it's like to build something from scratch. That means they think like an owner, not a hired gun. They understand the emotional weight of entrepreneurship, cash flow anxiety, employee dynamics, market changes, and they tailor their advice accordingly. Entrepreneurial consultants don't just analyze, they relate. They've been in the trenches and their advice reflects lived experience, not just textbook knowledge. This type of consultant doesn't pitch cookie-cutter frameworks. They design solutions that respect your budget, bandwidth, and unique business model. Next, you want somebody that cares about outcomes, not just deliverables. Too many consultants deliver a thick report filled with recommendations, then disappear. But what a small business really needs is execution support and accountability. Outcome-driven consultants focus on impact, increasing revenue, reducing costs, improving retention, scaling operations. They track metrics, align with KPIs, and stay engaged until the goals are met. A report is nice, but a result is much better. Next, they co-create, not dictate. The best consultants don't walk in with all the answers. They ask questions first. They listen deeply. Then they build solutions with you, not for you. This approach is called co-creation and is especially effective in dynamic, resource-constrained environments like small businesses, where flexibility and ownership are keys to success. Co-creation fosters buy-in from the team, encourages experimentation, and leads to more sustainable implementation. Next, you want a consultant who understands people and culture, not just processes. Small businesses aren't just systems and strategies. They're made of people, employees, customers, partners, and families. Entrepreneurial consultants who understand this human element deliver better, longer-lasting results. They're able to read the room, and they coach the founder. They help navigate hard conversations, and they empower teams. In short, they help you build a business that works for people. Next, you want a consultant who empowers, not enslaves. Some consultants create dependency. Every time something changes, the client has to call them back. That's bad business. Great business consultants leave you and your team stronger. They transfer knowledge, they build capacity, and they introduce tools that keep working even after they're gone. This is what separates a trusted ally from a transactional vendor. If a consultant isn't empowering you to stand on your own, they may not have your long-term best interest in mind. And finally, you want a consultant who can see the whole business, not just a single piece of it. Small business challenges are rarely isolated. A marketing issue might stem from poor customer service. A hiring problem might be rooted in unclear strategy. Strong consultants practice systems thinking, the ability to see how different parts of the business interact. They connect the dots across departments and help you make decisions with broader consequences in mind. Don't hire consultants who solve in silos. Hire those who build bridges between your people, processes, and purpose. This approach results in a smarter strategy and stronger business. Here's a quick checklist to help you decide if a consultant is truly an ally. They listen more than they speak. They ask insightful questions. They explain complex things in a simple way. They prioritize your goals, not their frameworks. And they leave your business more capable than when they found it. They value the relationship over the transaction. Finally, don't wait for a crisis to hire a consultant. Many small business owners wait too long before seeking help. They bring in a consultant when sales are down, staff morale is low, or they feel stuck. But the best time to build relationships with consultants is before you're overwhelmed. Think of it as an investment in clarity, confidence, and growth. The right consultant won't just solve problems, they'll become a long-term thinking partner, a true ally who helps you navigate complexity, seize new opportunities, and become the kind of business leader who builds not just a company, but a legacy. Choose wisely, and remember, the strongest entrepreneurs are never alone. Our next article for this episode comes from Inc. magazine, and the title is Unpaid Customer Invoices Are Piling Up, Squeezing Small Businesses. A new survey finds a majority of entrepreneurs reporting growing numbers of late payments that cost companies an average of $40,000 annually. It's tricky enough for owners of small companies to keep adjusting to unexpected developments that disrupt even the best laid business plans. But entrepreneurs can really be thrown off balance when customers start paying their bills late, an income-choking delinquency challenge that a growing number of founders say is a serious problem. The rising number of late payments to small business owners was measured in a recent survey by Invoice Factoring Specialist Gateway Commercial Finance. It polled 500 of those companies and found that 73% report that customer delinquency numbers increased over the past year. That's forcing entrepreneurs to take the time and effort to find diplomatic ways to nudge clients to settle their bills. But late payments are also considerably restricting founders' cash flows, requiring over half to delay or cancel investment, expansion, or hiring plans. In addition to the rising number of tardy payments, the length of customer delinquencies is also growing. Two-thirds, or 64% of participants, said they had invoices that were 90 days overdue on their books, with 12% waiting on bills up to 120 days. The amount of money tied up in those outstanding notes represented, on average, 11% of a company's total revenue. Even when straggling customers finally pay up, the small businesses involved has usually lost money from either using credit that carries additional interest charges to compensate for tardy funds, or through lost income opportunities. The average annual cost from late payments was $39,406, with 10% of respondents saying they suffered over $100,000 in related expenses. How do entrepreneurs typically bridge those financial shortfalls while waiting for late payments to arrive? Top methods cited were short-term loans, credit cards, business lines of credit, peer-to-peer solutions, and merchant cash advances. Nearly 70% of respondents say they either used their personal savings or had taken on debt to cover decreased company cash flow. About a quarter of participants blamed late customer payments for what they described as unstable liquidity levels. When asked how long their business could hold out if all invoices stopped being paid, a third of participants said they'd have 3 to 6 months. A quarter estimated 4 to 8 weeks, and 18% said they'd last less than a month. But even without those dire scenarios, late payments penalize small company owners in other ways. Just over half of businesses responding said delinquencies forced them to postpone purchasing equipment or inventory, and 63% said they had had to forsake business expansion plans. Some also had to pass the pain of late payments on to their own partners, around 43% reporting having belatedly settled bills with vendors because of a shortage of funds, and 34% said they'd been overdue paying rent or mortgage installments. But respondents also confess that what many appear to be a logical solution to late payments is also too delicate to risk. Fully 60% of participating founders said they avoid confronting customers over delinquent bills in fear of damaging their relationship. That discretion is all the more remarkable in light of 53% of respondents reporting having to turn down promising business opportunities because of reduced cash flow from overdue invoices. Aware that the rising problem of late payments may worsen, a majority of entrepreneurs are taking steps to protect themselves from the problems that produces. About 62% said they've now established contingency plans to bridge reduced cash flows from delinquencies, as well as to tide them over in the event of an economic downturn. Late payments are making it harder for small businesses to grow, plan ahead, or even keep the light on, the Gateway report on the survey said. Business owners are starting to rethink how they manage those delays. Many are exploring faster, more flexible funding options to keep things running smoothly, and the goal is to stay prepared, no matter how unpredictable payments may become. Our next article can be found in Black Enterprise magazine, and the title is Small Business AI Adoption Declines to Just 28%. Is artificial intelligence or AI living up to the hype for small business owners? Next's recent survey of AI tool adoption for small business shows that many are dialing it back. Independent operators rely on AI tools to be more efficient, and they're optimistic about its impact. But many more seem to have stopped incorporating AI into their business operations since they were last surveyed in 2024. And cost and complexity seem to be the barriers keeping them out. How do many small businesses use AI? Next surveyed 1,500 small business owners in April of 2025 to ask about their AI usage and plans for implementation. While 42% of small businesses reporting using AI in 24, our 25 survey reveals a significant drop to just 28%. Why the loss of interest? Some small business owners, like Danilo Corviglio and founding partner of translation agency Espresso Translation, use AI regularly, but worry they can add business risk. I use AI behind the scenes to streamline prep, clean terminology, and test briefs, but not to replace translators or project managers. AI can't sense tone shifts, legal nuance, or when a vague phrase could cost a client down the line. It doesn't ask follow-up questions or spot formatting issues across languages. That's where people still matter. Accuracy, accountability, and context still belong to the humans. Enthusiasm for AI adoption seems to have cooled. Last year, 27% planned to increase their business AI use. When asked in 25, only 23% would definitely consider adding an AI. This year, just 19%, roughly 1 in 5 business owners, might add it, and 58% say they don't plan to use AI at all. Here are 7 ways that small businesses are using AI. While AI adoption seems to be down across the board, those that are using it are finding some business value. Survey data shows small businesses mostly use AI for content creation and marketing, customer service, and product suggestions. Small businesses also use technology to help streamline calendars and scheduling tasks, as well as accounting and payroll. First, personalized content and automated marketing. In 2025, the key to leveraging AI in your marketing is to let it help you, not replace you as the expert, said marketing and AI expert Brendan Egan, founder and CEO of digital marketing agency Simple SEO Group. AI marketing tools can help small businesses create personalized content and promotions, and small business owners are clued in. According to Next Surveys, 11% of respondents use AI for marketing content, making it the top use case. Small business owners need to understand AI's limitations and how to use it well, says Egan. While AI can write content, doing so may harm your site's Google rankings. While AI can craft customer-facing emails, many companies have been caught sending something they may not want to because AI wrote it. And there's no shortage of tools to help you with your work. Jasper and Copy.ai can help automate copy creation, and Canva and Midjourney can assist with images and graphics. Currently, we are advising small businesses to leverage AI to help them with their marketing and not do it for them, Egan says. For example, if you're writing a blog for SEO purposes to drive more traffic to your site, ask AI to come up with an outline and some facts for you so it's easier and faster for you to write the content. Ask AI to help you come up with the creative ideas for ads in your niche or suggestions for keywords. Second, chatbots for immediate customer service information. The Next survey found that 9% of small business owners use AI for customer service using tools like AI assistant chatbots. These smart bots can free up your time to focus on more complex customer interactions and could even help with cross-selling or upselling opportunities. Look for AI-powered chatbot platforms that allow you to build customized chatbots without coding skills. Third, product recommendation tools for customized experiences. The Next survey shows that 8% of business owners use AI for product recommendations to help small businesses boost sales and increase customer loyalty. Platforms like Shopify's AI-powered recommendations or Amazon's personalized analyze a customer's purchase history and browsing patterns to suggest relevant products. Next, virtual assistants for scheduling and device control. Virtual assistants such as Siri, Alexa, and Google Assistant aren't just for a personal task. They're helpful in business, too. The Next survey shows that 8% of business owners use AI to manage schedules and appointments, set reminders, answer quick queries, and control smart devices at work. Fifth, accounting and payroll tools. Although AI accounting and payroll tools can make financial management tasks easier, reduce errors, and save time. 7% of small business owners already use these tools to operate their business, the Next study shows. Popular platforms such as QuickBooks, Xero, Gusto, and FreshBooks already use AI technology to automate repetitive financial tasks such as invoice processing, track expenses, and manage payroll. Six, data analysis and visual reporting. AI-powered data tools like IBM Watson and Google's Looker Studio can help businesses understand complicated data like weaknesses, opportunities, product pricing, and forecasting. These tools use machine learning to spot patterns and create clear visual reports to help you make more informed business decisions. 7. Intelligent document processing for invoices, shipping transcripts, and more. AI document tools can boost efficiency by pulling data from things like invoices, receipts, and purchase orders to cut down on errors from manual data entry. And if your business paperwork is suddenly digital, it can be easier to store, sort, and search. Translation company owner Cavelio uses AI to generate internal docs more quickly, edit the templates given to clients, and review the translation briefs. But for AI, these tasks could introduce liability. We once translated a supplier contract from German, and the AI completely misread embedded acronyms. A human translator flagged it in 2 minutes, double-checked with the client, and fixed it before it caused damage. AI just moved on. In our field, that's the problem. What are some common barriers to adopting AI for businesses? Business owners generally fall into two buckets when it comes to integrating AI, says Egan. Those are that are using it too much or those who are not using it at all. In our experience, there are very few businesses using AI properly. The next survey data reveals small business owners have mixed feeling about AI's impact. While some owners believe AI could boost revenue and operational efficiency, many remain unsure or skeptical about its value. Some believe AI won't affect their businesses in any way, believe it's a threat to their business, or that it will decrease their profits. A few obstacles that hinder AI's adoption include the cost of implementation. Though AI can often help cut costs, the price of adopting AI remains a hurdle for many small businesses. The Bipartisan Policy Center reports that 55% of small business owners identify cost as a reason not to use AI. Next, lack of education. A 25 survey by Service Direct found that 62% of small businesses cite a lack of understanding about AI's benefits as a barrier to adoption. Many small businesses owners still view artificial intelligence tools as too complicated or meant only for larger businesses. And finally, the challenge of data management. Data helps AI make more accurate predictions, but collecting, organizing, analyzing data can be difficult for small businesses. A HyperScience and Harris Poll study found half of the organizations don't use AI for document processing or workflow improvements, and 77% underuse available data needed for accurate AI models. Our next article comes from Wired Magazine, and the title is, "Hey, It's Time to Kill Siri." After almost 10 years, Google Assistant was recently axed in favor of Gemini. Siri gets a bad rap, so now is the time for Apple to make a change, too. If you had a passing interest in Apple over the past year, you've likely heard of the company's struggle in the AI race. Apple Intelligence, which arrived slightly late after the launch of the iPhone 16, fell short of expectations, and Apple has yet to deliver the much-improved Siri it promised at the Worldwide Developer Conference in 2024. Siri got a new look at an integration with ChatGPT, but its ability to understand your personal context via emails, messages, notes, and calendar was indefinitely delayed earlier this year, as Apple is reportedly facing several challenges. Even if Apple delivered a better Siri, would people use it? Despite arriving first, Siri has long been derided by iPhone owners, often the butt of a joke, as Google Assistant and Alexa rose to the top. But if Apple wants its customers to take the supposed improvements coming to the voice assistant seriously, it should consider taking a page from Google and killing it off for something new. Google has no problem with pulling the plug when things weren't working or priorities change. In fact, the search giant has a history of killing so many of its services that there's a website dedicated to tracking all of the gravestones. One of its most recent terminations, Google Assistant. Nearly 10 years since its debut, Google Assistant is in the process of being phased out from every ecosystem it was part of. Wear OS smartwatches is being replaced soon. Android Auto in the coming months. It's already no longer the default assistant on Android phones. By 26, it's unlikely we'll see the branding anywhere anymore. So ends the reign of arguably the most effective voice assistant of its time, gone without a care in the world. But Google's decision to kill it, instead of keeping the Google Assistant name, may have been smart. It's primarily branding, says Chris Harrison, who directs the Future Interfaces Group at Carnegie Mellon's Human-Computer Interaction Institute. But it underscores a technology reason, which is that the previous generation of these assistants really weren't very much like assistants. Asking for the weather and setting a timer, not very sophisticated. You wouldn't really ask a personal assistant for those mundane tasks. Gemini is completely different. It can rummage through your emails to find the location of your kid's soccer match, parse through large documents, and when paired with a camera-enabled device, understand what you're seeing and offer help. Its capabilities are vastly superior to what Google Assistant could do. Apple's goal is to achieve similar results in a more privacy-friendly way, so that when you have Siri connected to ChatGPT, your data is not passed off to OpenAI. Apple thought Siri's capabilities would grow, but that really didn't materialize. Siri kind of atrophied out of the gate, Harrison says. Now we're in this new generation of things that are really much more like assistants. They can do reasoning and personalization. But while Google Assistant and Gemini both have voice interfaces, and at a first glance they may share a similar look, they're two different applications. simply renaming it Google Assistant 2.0 would not spur people to use it in a fundamentally different way. It seems that switch to Gemini has been the key to moving customer understanding along. However, it's fair to say that Apple and even Amazon's Alexa have had a crucial cachet that Google Assistant never enjoyed. It wasn't unusual to hear Siri or Alexa's name in a movie or TV show. They were much more recognizable than Google's generic name voice assistant. This may be why Amazon decided to keep the Alexa branding and simply add a plus icon to denote the new souped-up version of Alexa powered by the latest large language models, and perhaps why Apple is still hanging on to Siri. This might have all been okay if Apple actually delivered on its promise and released a functioning, much-improved Siri when it originally said it would. With a massive marketing push to put Apple intelligence in everybody's mind, perhaps now a regretful move, it would have been a great opportunity to wow users with a much improved Siri. Months later, customers are left wondering why Siri, new look and all, still lags behind. But the broader problem affecting all large language models isn't just the branding, but the user interface. Harrison compares it to the days of command line computing and the shift to the graphical user interface in the 80s. It wasn't the graphics that made the latter more popular, but the discoverability and explorable interface. In the command line era, you had to remember how to do anything. With GUI, you could put anybody in front of a computer and they'd be able to figure it out just by navigating the operating system. If you put someone in front of ChatGPT or Gemini, say it's an incredible tool, and tell them to ask it anything, they'll just stare blankly at the blinking prompt. It's like what we've gone back 30 years in interface design. They have no idea what to do or say. Harrison says he did this exact experiment with his parents. They asked what the weather was tomorrow, and the AI responded that it didn't have that information. We've regressed in discoverability, he says. A regular person, not the tech people. If all they've been doing is setting timers with Siri for the past 10 years, and now they have to think about it in a fundamentally different way, that's an extremely hard problem. Some sort of renaming of the application is going to be important. Saying goodbye to Siri would be a big move for Apple, after all. It has spent more than a decade investing in it. But more people today still use it for playing music, checking the weather, and setting timers, and aren't even pushing the boundaries of its current relatively limited capabilities. It's hard to see that changing anytime soon, even if Siri's feature-packed next generation arrives as promised. For 90% of the planet, this kind of AI revolution has totally gone over their head, Harrison says. Like the 10-year transition from a command line to a graphical user interface, rethinking the way we use the personal voice assistants will take time and education, but maybe a new name will help Apple with the transition. Our next article continues from Fast Company magazine, and it's called We Can Reshore American Manufacturing. The challenge is high for existing manufacturers, and here's how we begin. In my last Fast Company column, I shared my reasons for manufacturing my electric trucks in the U.S. I'm not alone. While nearshoring to North America has been underway for several years, the current tariff shifts and shipping complexities make U.S. manufacturing a higher priority still. However, there were almost 300,000 factories in the U.S. as of 2021, and of those, 846 employ 1,000 people or more. Some of these are my engineering firm's clients, giving us a front-row seat to the complexity of retrofitting an existing factory to full U.S. manufacturing. While building a new factory is expensive and lengthy, these companies' tasks are more difficult still. There is a good reason for making the shift as quickly as possible. Moving to most or fully U.S. manufacturing brings higher visibility, faster response time, and higher resilience to supply chain disruption, as well as greater protection from tariff shifts and geopolitical change. But if you're early in the process, here's my advice for your transition. First, determine a priority ranking for the refining and raw materials you shift to in-country and North American sourcing. Give highest ranking to categories including defense, high-value items such as steel, aluminum, and rare earth minerals, and consumer safety items such as pharmaceutical components, etc. Be more strategic in the offshore suppliers you continue using for non-advanced manufacturing by prioritizing closer and more geographic-friendly locations for production and shipment such as Mexico and Argentina. Third, utilize government-backed capital where possible for extracting mining materials and metals such as lithium, red mud, magnesium, etc. Fourth, beyond the high-ranking product categories, move to domestic suppliers for primary materials such as steel, aluminum, cement, and plastic. Likewise, reduce offshoring of technical staff as well as raw materials where possible. Fifth, use all means possible to become power independent through solar production, microgrids, and nuclear power production. Six, consider creating a 4-year completion bonus for military vets. Hire vets wherever possible as they make great workers and entrepreneurs. Likewise, we can press for future policy changes that best support Made in America manufacturing as follows. First, encourage shipbuilding in the U.S. as well as creating new means of automated freight transit. Second, work toward transformation plans for government-funded R&D to include more attractive loans, rebates, and grants, as well as programs for tax-free status for intellectual property during commercialization to incent and support organizations making the shift. Third, consider energy rebates to U.S. manufacturers and distributors to make American manufacturing more cost-effective and viable. Fourth, create policies to include the cost of offshore staff in tariff calculations. Expand trade relationships with Caribbean nations for products such as sugar, avocados, bananas, etc. Fifth, avoid or even ban foreign ownership of the food supply chain. Six, create fair competition for government contracting. And seventh, make health supplements and homeopathic medicines tax deductible to promote a healthy workforce. While it may not be readily evident, these policy changes are related to successful reshoring. In all, we need larger scale, lower cost, and more automated and simplified mechanisms for product manufacturing. These issues, in my experience, are as equally important as the raw materials we require. We need increased support for niche manufacturing. In my opinion, we also need deregulation and increased access to land, particularly in the West. The federal government owns great quantities of available land, which is choking available supply. I believe we need better education, self-reliance, health, and incentive structures to get the capital, entrepreneurs, and workers for Made in America manufacturing. Our next article appears in Forbes magazine, entitled 4 Strategies for Entrepreneurs to Stay Profitable in 2025. As we continue to navigate market turmoil, tariff-related uncertainty, decelerating consumer spending, and the ongoing waves of AI disruption, entrepreneurial leaders, whether full-time entrepreneurs, side hustlers, or intrapreneurs, must contend with the fact that we no longer live in the small business heyday of 2021 and 2022. Entrepreneurs who want to survive this particular phase, when organizations and individuals alike are holding on to their money, must deploy new strategies to be successful. Success now requires increased strategic flexibility and a problem-solving approach over a rigid and idealistic focus on what the entrepreneurial leader wants and envisions. Here are 4 ways entrepreneurs can navigate the current economic reality and landscape and still emerge in a profitable fashion. First, stay flexible, but know what your top priority is. It used to be that entrepreneurs could build and sustain a decently successful venture by simply following the old rules. Clarify your ideal client or your customer avatar, sharpen your unique value proposition and differentiating factors, build out your offerings and pricing models, and market to your ideal client or customer. Now markets shift and shrink far too rapidly to rely on the old approach. AI is changing how people buy, spend, and invest their money. Services that used to carry prestige and command premium pricing are now possible to DIY using AI tools. Products that may have sold easily through traditional SEO or marketing methods are undiscoverable in the world of generative engine optimization. Heightened everyday costs continue to impact spending patterns and every week bring a new set of trends. Entrepreneurs who want to survive must meet our current reality by staying as flexible as the market is unpredictable. That said, business owners need not despair. Not everything can be in flux all of the time. Identify one core element of your business to keep fixed. This could be your service or your product line. It could be your target market. Everything outside of that, however, must remain fluid. If you are committed to a service offering that is dear to your heart, understand that the market for that service may not overlap with your ideal client avatar. You must be willing to sell to those who will buy. For example, if you run a coaching business and are committed to offering high-touch coaching services, you may have to expand or shift your target market from rising professionals to executives who have greater access to discretionary income. On the other hand, if you're committed to a particular customer niche, then be willing to adapt your offerings and product lines continually. That community's taste, spending habits, and level of economic power is likely in flux now. If you're a furniture seller and your target market is small business owners, you may have to shift from selling high-end office furniture and executive desks to offering modular workspace solutions and portable standing desk converters to accommodate the reality of hybrid work arrangements for tighter budgets. Second, cast a wider net. Regardless of what your non-negotiable element of business is, all entrepreneurs must cast a far wider net than in the past. A business must reach a greater number of prospective clients and customers in terms of geography, demographics, and psychographics in order to convert enough businesses. With spending continuing to decrease or remain uncertain at best, diversifying and expanding the pool of individuals and companies who trust your business enough to purchase is imperative. Third, experiment more. Another common pitfall among entrepreneurs and business owners, particularly those who have experienced past success, is that they get stuck in a rut and are unable to stomach sufficient experimentation. To stay stagnant in a fast-moving environment is a losing strategy. Instead, entrepreneurs must remain agile, nimble, and willing to experiment and fail in every aspect of the business, from market research to pricing strategy to bundling of products and services to marketing channels and content to market position and target audience. Successful entrepreneurs will test out significantly more ideas than in the past so they can truly understand how the landscape of consumer sentiment is shifting and keep steering their business in the right direction. Fourth and last, reverse engineer your business. The classic business startup model focused on what entrepreneurs wanted to offer to their ideal clients and customers. That approach will fail in times of economic uncertainty. Now entrepreneurs must reverse this approach and start with what problems need solutions and hone in on what solutions people are willing to spend on. Corporate and individual spending is currently plagued by austerity measures, which means the entrepreneurial leader's approach must be even sharper. Observe what people are actually spending on, what pain points they're raising, identify gaps where you are uniquely positioned to provide the solutions that they seek. And finally, when the going gets tough, entrepreneurs must be strategic. If you're an entrepreneur who's determined to survive and thrive in the future, block time in your calendar in the next 4 weeks to assess and potentially overhaul your approach to business leadership. First, evaluate how rigid or flexible your current entrepreneurial approach is. Identify your top priority, your non-negotiable core element in business. Next, identify how you can expand your market reach and cast a much wider net than when it comes to potential clients and customers. And then choose three new products or services to test with your current audience. Try out new messaging to raise awareness around your brand to three new audiences, and finally, track your progress as you go. After 4 weeks, ask yourself what you've learned and how the results, the good, the bad, and the ugly, impact how you will continue to drive your business forward through uncertain times. Market volatility and rapid change require that all entrepreneurial leaders adapt strategically. The businesses that remain successful during this time are the ones that continue to find new clients and increase their market share using these targeted methods. Successful entrepreneurs aren't waiting for better conditions. They're reshaping their strategies to match current and evolving realities by embracing flexibility, expanding reach, experimenting boldly, and staying laser-focused on solving real acute problems. Entrepreneurs can turn uncertainty into opportunity and build businesses that thrive regardless of economic headwinds. And our final article this week comes from The Street, and it's talking about the economy this week, trade, inflation fears will grab the limelight. There are several economic reports worth looking at this week, but pay close attention to two economic events. One will come from London, the other comes Friday from Michigan. Both events can cause investors to buy or sell stocks, bonds, or even houses. Futures trading Sunday evening suggests stocks will open modestly lower on Monday. In between are two reports that will probably paint a benign inflation picture, at least for now. This week, tariff talks resume. The London event is the meeting between U.S. and Chinese trade officials trying to hammer out a workable tariff deal. Whether anything major will come from the meeting is unclear, but one can hope. The last time there were talks, the two sides agreed on May 21st to come to an agreement on the issues in 90 days. That would mean by August 11th, but little has happened since then, and the Trump administration is getting impatient. The U.S. team will include Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, and U.S. Trade Representative Jameson Greer. China's team will be led by Vice Premier He Lifting. At the start of their first meeting in Switzerland in May, the Chinese were charging 125% tariffs on U.S. goods. The U.S. had imposed 145% tariffs on Chinese goods. After the May meeting, the tariffs on Chinese goods were dropped to an average of 51%, and the Chinese tariffs on U.S. goods were dropped to an average of 32.6%. Complicating matters is China produces 90% of rare earth metals, important materials for the use in electronic vehicles and other products, and the country is now holding back on export licenses so non-Chinese companies can buy the materials. Without the rare earths, assembly lines could shut down. It sounds dull, but it isn't. China is a major force of everything from semiconductors and auto parts to Apple iPhones, and oh, let's not forget, most toys made for the holiday season are produced in China. If the London meeting goes badly, financial markets could swoon again. After President Donald Trump announced the U.S. tariff proposals on April the 3rd, the Standard & Poor's 500 fell 10.5% in 2 days. The next report is gauging how consumers see the economy, and Friday's event is the first cut of the University of Michigan's Consumer Sentiment Survey for June. The Michigan survey has been avidly followed this year because it suggests extreme worries about the economy, inflation, and tariffs. And its findings, whether optimistic or rotten, have the ability to move markets.